podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
Live special show. Neil's pointing at me because it's special because I'm hosting it. Because when you subscribe to the Anfield Wrap, you get this incredible content, this incredible series of shows called, well, we call it the award-winning Transfer Gutter Show. We call it that because my name's Rob Gutman, and it was a terrible pun on my name, wasn't it, Neil?
going back years.
And also the idea of we're all lying in the gutter and staring at the stars.
We're all lying in the gutter in the transfer filth. So this is going to be a taster for you of that dirt and filth. And we're going to do it in two parts, as we normally do tour live. The first part, we're going to cover the very, very exciting news that's sort of breaking, that Liverpool are closing in on Kefren Turam. Now, it's not the new... It all got a bit excitable on Twitter and social media last night that Turam had agreed terms with Liverpool. Liverpool had all but agreed a fee with Nice. There's even stuff this morning about planes being tracked from Nice to Blackpool Airport. I don't know what's going on. What's wrong with John Lennon Airport, by the way? Yeah. Is it because people know he is there, but in Blackpool they wouldn't have a clue?
I suspect Blackpool's not that busy.
Just not that busy.
Yeah.
That'd be why. That's what it is. But anyway, the rumour mill's hot. It's not come from the most sort of cast iron of sources, James Joyce. Paul Joyce, James Pierce. If you put them together, they're James Joyce.
Yes,
indeed. What a book they wrote once, or books. Anyway, I'm talking rubbish. Neil, let's start with you first on this one. I like to deal, before we start talking about the player, because he may be none of our business, are you sold on this latest tsunami of rumours coming in?
So I think that the players, that player and Kone, who we're linked with, and Vega, who we've been linked with, less so Gravenberch. I feel as though, you know, without talking down the wondrousness of Jörg Schmadtke, I sort of feel as though I could negotiate personal terms with them. And the reason why is because I just don't think that this is a difficult or complex one. They're going to want to come play for Liverpool. It's obviously a massive step up. We've got a fair amount of budget, given the nature of the footballers who've left on freeze before you even think about anything else, before you even include the idea of McAllister coming in. And then the other bits is it is sort of dotting the I's and crossing the T's. I don't think it's that complicated. We know Liverpool, for instance, have almost got a blueprint for this, where they get these lads in. They say to them, I think, it's 90 grand a week for your first contract. If you do well after 18 months, there will be a second contract. There's loads and loads of bits of evidence of that we've done over and over again. So that's what I'd expect it is. It's something in the arena of 90 grand a week, which would be more money than either of them are currently on at Nice or Mönchengladbach or Celta Vigo by some distance. So they're getting at least probably wages in Turam's case, maybe doubled. In the other two cases, maybe quadrupled or trebled. You know, this isn't difficult to get into play for Liverpool, and Liverpool are also able to point to the track record of, if this goes well, there's more in the post. And we can even have a bit of a chat about that now as to what that'll tend to look like, but it's in the ballpark of then an increase with a mini extension at the end because we all love you. So my point here is I don't think this is the difficult part. And the other thing that appears to have happened so far with these players, is certainly for Turam and Kone, is that they've been predominantly just linked with Liverpool. So that also makes me think that, and that's the other thing there, which is that I think that if they're getting a move to Liverpool, I'm going to refer to Liverpool as a Champions League club, even though they're not playing in the Champions League next season, but it's a Champions League style club. And I think that Liverpool's, they know they're approximately a first choice for Liverpool. They know what that can mean for their careers, for their lives, for their reputations, as all of that. So I think they're in until we decide, hypothetically, we didn't want either of them, or we decide it's been too difficult working with your club. And that's also a possibility here. So I'm not surprised by the idea, as I say, that Liverpool have agreed personal terms with any footballer in this class, really, because I just don't think it'd be that difficult for Liverpool to do.
No, we'll come on to the Kone, which are the rumours in parallel, and Vega and one or two others in part two. But just staying, Belinda, with the Turam thing specifically, and Neil's referenced that there. Judging the authenticity of a link, I always think it's interesting when the field seems to have been narrowed down to it's the Reds or no one. Because it's Turam, if you go back a couple of weeks, we were hearing talk of PSG, who I think have all but signed Ugarte since. We had heard murmurings around United, but that felt like a lazy link because Ratcliffe, the owner of Nice, and Ineos you know, he could be, he was the link, the bridge there to those rumours. But now it seems to be very much, it's Liverpool and Thuram, Liverpool and Thuram. Those are the names that are linked day in, day out now. We know Liverpool are interested because the guys we trust, the James Joyces of this world, have said so. Are you convinced this is a real live one now for the Reds that could actually get over the line and soon?
Yeah, I think so, because like you said, the links have been there now for a few weeks. And in terms of just the profile of the player, which I use loosely because I think with a player like him, he's only 22 and he's played varying roles in the midfield three across the past three seasons alone. I think you should more look at his sort of attributes and just in terms of his age and the amount of football he's already played and sort of the technical level he's already playing at shows why it'd be so important for Liverpool's midfield. I mean, also, like, the bar is on the floor for, like, Liverpool's midfield requirements at the moment. Like, it literally just needs to be someone who's played in midfield, is pretty good at it, but also they have a ceiling and they have more to develop at the moment. And he ticks all three of those boxes. And just, yeah, I think in terms of the player himself and where maybe he can fit in at Liverpool, I think his strengths clearly seem to be strength with running with the ball and like just being able to turn over that transition, particularly like in that second half of the middle third into the final third, which we've let so many midfielders go in the summer. There's space for so many types of midfielders that we need, so he suits that. But also just like technical ability in terms of dribbling with his footwork looks really strong. And it was something like he's in the 84th percentile in the league for like XG assists, so that shows that he's even got that final third play there. But I think it can still go up many, many levels, and I think you're investing in that development as much as you're investing in what he can bring in, say, in the next 12 months.
Adam, I think there's a conversation we're destined to have for the entire summer about footballers linked to and who signed for Liverpool, which is, yeah, it sounds really good, but where does he actually play? I mean, Belinda's touched on it there. But we're talking about McAllister. I feel like I'm having dreams about trying to second guess where McAllister might play for Liverpool. When you look at the metrics on and the heat maps on someone like Kefren Turam and others we'll discuss, it's hard to pin down exactly what type of midfielder they are. They all seem to be going, yeah, does a bit of defending, does a bit of attacking, quite box to box, really, if you think about it. It feels like we've been stuck in a sort of a loop with Jurgen and attackers for years, where Jurgen would introduce them in the press conference going, he was really cool because he could play in all the positions across the front three. And I think all the midfielders we are destined to be linked with or sign this summer, Jurgen will go, it's really cool because he could play in all the positions in the midfield. What's your thoughts?
Yeah, I think that's entirely deliberate. I don't think that's just coincidence or because the players haven't made up what they're doing or whatever. I think it's when you look at what happened last season in terms of the injuries and who the injuries were to and how the manager kept trying to sort of play different formations to try and get the best out of what he had, I think it was largely because a lot of the players that we had were in a defined position. And I think what we're seeing with Trent, for example, you know, you've had the kind of, you've been arguing that he is a midfielder now. Whereas wrongly. I think, exactly. Whereas most sensible people disagree. And I think there's a conversation to be had about, you know, what does it matter? If they're doing what the manager is asking of them on the pitch, what does it matter where we ostensibly think they're going to play? Because within a game, if you're playing, this is really unfair because I've not watched basically any of Vincent Kompany's Burnley. So I'm going off effectively. Why am I doing that? If you're playing Sean Dyche's Everton, where they're going to have 10 men behind the ball and that's the plan, you've got the entire pitch to play with, basically. So you don't need a player to be like, oh, well, I have to stick over here in this one particular section because that's the place I've been picked for. So I think the manager will want a group of players who can be intelligent and can be chopped and changed around the pitch depending on what it is that's taking place in front of them.
Yeah, I'm strangely excited by the tour. I'm thinking, I'll say strangely because I'd be lying if I've ever said I've ever consciously seen him play. I've YouTubed the ass off him and feel I have a sense of his stylistic approach to the game of football. But I'm excited by him because I don't think I'm alone in that. I think we're all glad about McAllister, but I think we needed post Bellingham blues. We needed a sense of, I think, having a bit of a leader in our coming into our midfield. Maybe that's the word I'm looking for. A presence stroke leader. And a lad who's 6'4" who seems as commanding potentially as this young man, admittedly. I'm not saying we're looking for a messiah exactly, but I think we are looking for something, a dominator in that midfield.
Quite possibly, but I'd like him to have kicked it in the goal more. Especially if we're thinking about playing them in attacking areas. If we are, and that's the key question on this, and this is back to the what and who's where, I'm all for the physicality, the size, the profile, the technique, the touch. And please, Belinda mentioned the through balls, the fact that he played more through balls than anyone else at Nice. But the truth of this is that his season last season at Nice was played entirely off the left-hand side, predominantly in left-hand side at centre midfield or a defensive midfield.
Very central though, isn't it?
I mean, it is, but it's still the left-hand side of the central part. That's where he was playing his football. It's where he's playing his trade. That's where we think McAllister's ending up, and it's sort of where where Jones is genuinely impressed. And the thing about Jones is he kicks it in the goal. And there's a lot of Dream 11s knocking around that people are doing, where they are putting Trent into midfield and putting someone next to him. And then they're picking, say, McAllister, who scored a good number of goals last season, but it's worth pointing out penalties and set pieces made up 5 of them. And if we're going to persist with this shape in this way, I think we need those two roles behind the front three, especially when people are writing down the front three as Diaz, Gakpo and Salah. That's not a front three that feels to me like there's quite as many goals as we'd like. And that's maybe a Diaz conversation, which is a separate point here, but they're all going to have to play together in some way, shape or form. And my concern is just, you know, I think you need those two roles, especially given how high they are when you're in possession, how close they are to being playmaking forces and all that sort of stuff. You need to genuinely feel as though, and the opposition need to think, these lads can score goals. That's been my major issue with Henderson playing the right-hand side of this shape, has been that at some point in every single game, the opposition's realised we're never going to pass to him when he's making a breaking run. And also that if he does get in, he's likely to blaze it over the bar.
But peak Klopp midfields have never scored goals,
I know,
really.
But this is now different. And this is back to the this is now different conversation. So if we're saying we're going back to the way in which we used to play, and then you can make, you know, really strong arguments that this suits down to the ground and so on. But then you're back to me then saying, but I don't want to ever start Diaz in a game that we need to score first in, because the Diaz output question becomes a sort of alive one in amongst all of that. I just think I don't want us to do is get to the end of this window and think we should have brought an attacking midfielder in. Because if you look at how everyone else is playing this shape, who's doing it, there's a really clear notion of who the attacking midfielder is every single time they step onto the pitch. And for Brighton, it has sometimes been McAllister. But, you know, I think there needs to be a feeling of genuine threat from whoever it is who's playing, whoever the two players are who are effectively playing behind and supplementing the central striker, especially if that striker's going to be dropping in a great deal. All of this makes it sound like I'm not in favour of the player. Every clip I watch of him makes him look exciting. I also see how it could be Liverpool are looking at him and thinking, you know, after 6 months with us, he's playing number 6 because we like the fact that he can get out from under his feet. He can look after the ball. He's physically dominant. You know, I like Kone as a link as well. You know, all of this.
Well, Fabinho, Henderson, Wijnaldum all could play 8s and 6 roles, couldn't they?
But Wijnaldum and Henderson didn't score goals.
This is my main
point here, Rob, is that I think, you know, the way we're playing is I think one of them at least. You know, but I, you know, one of the reasons why I love Jones in there is Jones looks like 10, 12 a season. You know, it's no surprise. Curtis Jones' brace against Leicester is the first time a Liverpool midfielder scored a brace since Alex Oxlade-Chamberlain away at Genk in 2019. We've had a pandemic since then. The one before that is Wijnaldum against Barcelona, when the hand of history was upon his shoulder. I can't even remember what the one before that was. And, you know, but Jones has got that. I look at Jones and I feel like Jones looks like, you know, if Jones played 38 league games, I think he'd get 12, 15 goals, because that's the sort of footballer he is. I want that on the other side as well. And that's my... I'm saying all this like I don't think the player looks great and I want us to buy him, because I do want us to buy him and I think he looks great. But either we think he's got a ceiling around what he can do in the penalty area and what he can do in front of goal, and he's just got not near it yet. But to be clear, he's got 160 senior appearances and 9 goals. So we're asking him to move. And even if we allow for the fact that a lot of those early appearances will be substitutions, we're asking him to move, say, from 1 in 10 to getting closer to 1 in 4, which is a bit of a journey, unless we're thinking about playing him at the 6.
Or there's another variation on that, unless we aren't going to persist as our default the Trent experiment and going back to a more traditional Klopp 4-3-3 where goals from midfield are a bonus rather than a necessity.
Which, if we are doing it, would have been good if loads of people had said that to Trent before he did loads of interviews.
Yeah, I know. Someone should have told us. Have we got any inserts to do before we go to the break?
Should we do an insert? We've got inserts, yeah. Do you want to do inserts?
You do some inserts for me.
Okay, excellent stuff. We are doing inserts coming up, talking about... Africa OEA is me with Paul Dehaney. And then after that, as Liverpool women have moved back into Melwood, Harriet Pryor spoke to Emma Sanders yesterday in that studio. I know because I walked out and disrupted it. Hopefully they've edited that correctly. And that's got sorted out. So coming up first and foremost, there's me with Paul Dehaney on Africa OEA. And then there's Emma Sanders on Liverpool women in Melwood. And the time is 15:46. Joined by Paul Dehaney, who, if you listen to our Friday show especially, you'll have heard him for a few years now, talking about his beloved Tottenham Hotspur, even though he lives in the city of Liverpool. And the reason why Paul lives in the city of Liverpool, I say he lives in the city of Liverpool, I mean, the number of times Paul will turn up and tell me he's just been at a conference somewhere unbelievably exotic is phenomenal. And I absolutely always adore the stories because Paul runs the Africa OEA Festival, which remains free this year. It's the 17th and 18th of June in Sefton Park. We'll come on to the music. I think the bit that gets missed, not by people who go in the end, but when you do these sorts of chats, everyone wants to talk about the lineup. But we'll start off talking about the fact that it's not the music, it is the music, but it's also the culture, it's the food, there's workshops, it's dance, there's loads and loads going on there that is separate before you even talk about the lineup.
I think that, in the time that I've been working with OEA, I think I started in 98 and it was just a stage and, main stage, and that was it. There was nothing else. And it was almost every year, it was about how can we add different elements to include more people? Because I know it sounds corny, but our whole thing is about being fully inclusive. And by that, we just mean anyone in the world can come to that park and feel like they belong there. So how can we do that? So we program DJs for people who are into all different music genres. We have, as you say, lots of workshops, whether that be dance workshops or, book workshops or reading workshops or whatever. We also have stalls, not just selling African and Caribbean food, but food from all over the world. I think we got a record number of stalls this year, counting like 86 this year. that's going to be fantastic and always adds to the colour and vibrancy. But, just the smells of food, the mix of people, there's a certain unique atmosphere and it does all come back to the music on the main stage, but it's been something that it's taken a long time to create. But it's definitely, I'm proud of what my team's produced in terms of this festival.
In terms of the festival, when we do get into the lineup, there's a number, because I know I was going to talk to you about it, listen to a couple of bits and pieces. Love Fra.
They're brilliant.
Aren't they just? I mean, it's so, so energetic. You've got them. I've started with them because they're sort of halfway down the bill. There's just loads and loads of energy in there. I watched a couple of videos last night of what they're about. Everyone's going to absolutely love them, I think.
I think that you hit on something there. It's about the dancing and the energy. It's like, it'll be different. There's so many bands that I see when I go around the world at these conferences and showcases, and they're absolutely fantastic. But it might be a soloist playing like a violin or something on stage. It's not going to work at OEA. There has to be a specific type of band that we're looking for. And it's all about dance and energy and making people move, colour, vibrancy. And also, we like to, cover as many different countries and different places that we've never had before. Having a nice gender split on stage as well, yeah. Making sure we feature a lot of female, not just on stage, but also the DJ side of it as well. So there's a lot that goes into the program, and it's not just about, let's choose, 10 international bands and put them on a stage. It's also how do they fit together in terms of the actual programmation, in terms of the the different styles, make sure they don't clash. You know, there's a lot goes into it.
There's a lot that goes into it because it is, you know, there's some festivals that you go to, and I'm not saying that you wouldn't want this, but there's some festivals that you go to where there's 15 stages and stuff like that, and therefore everything can have its own flavour, its own vibe. As you say, you need one focal point, don't you, that everyone can get behind.
Yeah.
So you want to be able to do the different showcase. So there's, I might make a mess of the pronunciation, someone else will listen to in the run-up to this, but Alagate Oho and his Sounds of Joy, you know, it's gospel, so gospel-tinged, you know, and I really enjoyed listening to that.
But ironically, they're from the same place that Frar are from, but it's a completely different sound.
I didn't even realise.
So one's traditional and one's sort of like a more of a modern twist on that, you know.
But you need, therefore, them to play off each other on stage, if you see what I mean, because you're basically saying, this is your day.
Yeah.
And there's the DJ stuff and there's other bits and pieces that's happening all around, but that focal point of that stage is everything, isn't it? So it's got to work that way.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, the last few years, for instance, we've been trying to sort of cater for the younger audience. So we've got Zai Zai on, and Zai Zai is sort of like, you know, more of a sort of Afro pop artist, if you like, but it's something that the younger people in the audience can relate to, but also it's still Oye friendly. You know, he's going to be playing with a full live band, which is, I don't think he's ever done that before. So, you know, we always try to make sure it fits within the ethos of the Oye festival.
Other thing, big one, is Soyin Kuti and Egypt 80. I mean, that is the headline. There's Tanya Stevens as well, who is a legendary figure from dancehall. Those two to headline across the Saturday and Sunday is absolutely massive.
I think that, you know, the love we've been getting for both those headliners has been great. Soyin Kuti especially, you know, I think, I don't even know that people know this, but he actually studied at Lipa back in the day.
Did he?
Yeah. And I'd done a podcast with him a few weeks ago that's going to be on soon, talking about his time at Lipa and stuff. So there's a definitive link with Liverpool. And obviously everyone knows the story about his father. But yeah, his show, I saw him actually, I'm going to sound like I'm giving it here, but I saw him perform in Medellin in Colombia, in this outdoor festival.
Of course you did.
And I was at the front like a fan, man. I was dancing, jumping about. So, yeah, I think I've been trying to get him for a few years. So to actually secure that booking was a good one for us.
And Tanya Stevens.
Tanya Stevens, I was in Jamaica. Oh, God, here I go again.
So Paul comes in at this Friday show, and either on the way in or on the way out, I'll go, so, you know, our things or something like that. And it'll always become, well, I was just in Jamaica, or I was just, and every single time I'll be like, oh,
but do you know what's great is that I'm going to these places, and by the way, I'm not paying to go to these places. Like, I'm not, you know, using OEA's funds or anything. I get specially invited.
Yeah.
I take part in conferences, mentoring sessions.
Yeah, they're bringing
sessions.
You in to do the stuff. Yeah, exactly. All that sort of stuff.
But a part of that is seeing the showcases of these live bands, and I see, you know, literally hundreds of them. But what's great is actually I'm doing that, and then I'm bringing the artists here, and you're actually seeing them on stage in Liverpool. So, you know, some places I've seen in like a dingy spot in like Lisbon, and like they're an amazing band, and it's just thought, how are you going to transform them and get them to Oye? And to make it actually happen is a challenge in itself.
That it actually happens, let's be clear, it's a free festival, so it's in Central Park. Central Park. We've got Sefton Park, not in Central Park. That's in
We're twinned with...
Twinned with. But you need partners for that. You need support for that from a great many places. That's ongoing. From people themselves, you can donate. But there's Arts Council funding, there's Liverpool City Council funding, there's Culture Liverpool funding. All these bodies are so important for you to be able to keep this free.
Yeah, they are. But, I mean, I've noticed this year that probably everything's gone up maybe 7 to 10%, and you know, if you're talking about a couple of quid, that's not a lot of money, but when you're talking these invoices are thousands of pounds, you can see you can see the sort of levels of increases that we're talking about, and it's really, really important that, you know, I think people are under the impression that, you know, it's all paid for by the city, but it isn't. You know, this is costing over 300 grand now to produce. When I started, it was probably about, you know, 25 grand. So you know, just to keep it free, people have to donate, buy T-shirts, buy merchandise, definitely buy a drink from the OEA bar, because all that money goes back. And or you can, you know, there's about 70 volunteers walking about with, you know, QR codes on the back of their T-shirts, donation buckets, donation. You know, there's many, many ways you can help to keep the festival free. But it's so important if we want it to continue.
I mean, you've got a monopoly.
We have. And he sounds like you're saying I've got a monopoly on African
festivals.
No,
you've got a monopoly. Literally, there's a board game. You can buy an OEA board game, which really makes me laugh.
It's funny. And you've got all the great, you know, Liverpool football clubs on there, of course. All the museums, galleries, you know, theatres and stuff. And then on the Orange Square, which apparently this, yeah, I don't know if they were just trying this on me when they were telling me about it, but apparently the Orange Square on the Monopoly board is the most landed on square.
Tactically, it's the one you want. Yeah, you know, as a man who plays and thinks about board games too much, it's the one you want. The oranges, yeah.
It's the most landed on square statistically. But yeah, great to be appearing on that. And of course, you can get that merchandise all on our website, africaoye.com.
It's all there at africaoye.com, as well as the information about everyone who's playing and what is around. All the merchandise is there. You can donate through there as well. Paul's doing it year after year. I often wonder what you like the weekend after. What does your weekend
Glastonbury
after
is the weekend after. I don't go to Glastonbury, but my wife and I will hire like a cottage in North Wales, and we will go there and have our own little private Glastonbury.
And just watch it all on the telly.
And just watch it all on the telly and watch everybody else suffer.
Thanks to Paul. Let's get over.
And it is great to have Emma Sanders from the BBC with us for Tour Live to talk about Liverpool women buying back Melwood to provide the women's team with an elite training centre. So Emma, first of all, just to provide a bit of context, how long have Liverpool been looking to move away? Was it always planned for next season, and how have they stumbled across Melwood?
Well, it's actually later than planned. I remember having a conversation with Russ Fraser, who's the director of the women's team, I think over a year ago, and I think the initial plan was actually to get it in place for the start of last season. Well, the season just gone. Obviously, there's delays that's happened to that, but I think it's probably worked out for the best. I think the delays, actually, in hindsight, now that we know, it's because they were waiting to see whether they could buy back Melwood, and that was always an option. There were several sites.
It was always rumoured, wasn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. There were several options they were looking at, several sites around Merseyside. At the moment, you know, they're technically still training at Solar Campus, which is Tranmere Rovers' training ground, so they've been sharing that with the League Two club. They've always planned to move. It's just when, and it's probably taking a lot longer than they had planned. But yeah, finally they've got the most desirable outcome, I think.
So what is the outcome? Can you just talk that through for people that aren't aware of the news?
Yeah, so my understanding is that they won't actually move in immediately in pre-season because there will be further investment into Melwood. So basically the training ground that was left, they're then going to develop upon that so that there's, you know, better facilities there. There's more space to be able to cater for the Merseyside community, which is something that I think was really important to Liverpool as a football club, that it wasn't just a case of buying it back and then using it for the women's first team and the girls' professional academy, but actually also to keep providing sort of grassroots football classes and things through obviously Jamie Carragher and Robbie Fowler. So they'll be expanding areas. I think there's about three full-size pitches there at the moment. They might be adding another one. But yeah, all those little intricacies will be added over the next couple of weeks, and then the women will move in with enough time really before the start of the new WSL season.
I think it marks a huge change, doesn't it? You mentioned they were sharing with Tranmere. This feels like they're becoming their own independent team. They feel like they've got their own facilities, their own gym. They don't have to share anything. They don't have to think about when they can train and don't have to clash with another League Two team, as you mentioned. What do you think the significance is in terms of Liverpool women being taken seriously as its own entity?
Yeah, absolutely massive. And for a lot of the reasons there that you mentioned, I know that when manager Matt Beard came back, obviously he won the two WSL titles with Liverpool. So you would think that in the 10 years since he left, that when he returned, there'd be significant progress, and there wasn't at all. If anything, the club had gone backwards. So he came in, and I know that his sort of views were very much aligned of that of Russ Fraser and few others on the Liverpool Women board. And it was a case of finding that space where they could firstly grow their own culture, secondly have first-class professional elite facilities just to catch up with the other big clubs. You know, you look at the likes of Chelsea, they're miles ahead than Liverpool in the women's game. Arsenal, they're playing regularly at the Emirates Stadium. They've got first-class training facilities. And even clubs lower down, you know, in the table than Liverpool, you look at Brighton and Tottenham, who are both fighting relegation this year. They've got first-class facilities. So Liverpool really, a club of that magnitude, a club of that size, and also, you know, the brand and what it attracts in terms of the transfer window was a huge plus. And then players would come, look around the training ground and be like, what is this? This isn't the Liverpool that you would expect. So hugely, hugely significant moment for the club, and hopefully that'll really push forward the women's team.
Yeah, do you think it's significant as well, the timing of it? You mentioned there the summer signing, so will it be a huge bonus and something that will attract potential new players that are coming into the club?
Yeah, I would hope so, and I would think so. I think, you know, even if it's not something that happens in this immediate transfer window, certainly you'd be looking at January and thinking, okay, when you have a lot of the, you know, the Nordic teams, their transfer window then aligns with the January one. So a lot of, you know, kind of Swedish players who have been attracted to the WSL of late, that Arsenal have brought in some really top quality players. Yeah. Will they then start looking at clubs like Liverpool? Because if they can get top class training facilities and they can get all of those resources that have been elsewhere at other WSL clubs, why would you not want to come to play for Liverpool?
Can I touch on that quickly then? You mentioned there are some other clubs and their training facilities. Do most of them in the WSL, or at least the top teams, have their own high-level facilities already, and Liverpool are lagging behind a bit in that set?
Yeah, well, certainly, you know, the other top teams in the WSL, that is definitely something that they all have. Arsenal, Manchester City, Chelsea. Yeah, they've massively invested in their facilities over a long period of time. And then we've seen more recently clubs like Brighton, Everton, Tottenham, they are now starting to invest as well. So I think it's only a matter of time, really, that Liverpool got their act together, really. And yeah, certainly if you want to be a big club in the WSL, then you have to have big facilities now. And that's becoming a bit of a requirement.
Yeah, I'm going to read out what Liverpool's managing director, Andy Hughes, said about it. He said, "Now is the right time to make this move, and we're absolutely delighted that we've managed to take this opportunity to return to Melwood and to see it start a new chapter of Liverpool's commitment to our women's first team and academy. We also have an opportunity to further develop the use of the site to support the local community, as you mentioned earlier, by using it as an additional space for the LFC Foundation." So I think that is another thing as well, isn't it, that it is going to be used to better the community. But it does, for me, like you mentioned, mark a new era and a new chapter and a new beginning. And you saw that a bit last season when Liverpool promoted to the WSL, but this year feels even more significant. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, 100%. And I think it's really interesting that they've acknowledged the timing of it, because we know that the women's game's on the rise. Obviously, off the back of England winning the Euros last summer, the WSL has taken off this year. The new broadcast deal that came in place in 2021, that already saw, you know, the league grow as well. So I think over the last couple of years, the club has probably come under more scrutiny, because there's now more eyes on the women's game. There's more demands there. And there's also the opportunity for more money. And I think that's something that, you know, no club can deny. It's obviously a factor. While women's teams were obviously losing clubs money, you know, there wasn't that same kind of will or determination to invest. But now that there is a genuine prospect of earning money in the long term, and, you know, being really successful on a global scale, not just in football, but from a marketing and a business point of view, yeah, certainly that plays into the timing. And yeah, I think it's really interesting comments, but positive overall.
Yeah, it makes good business sense for Liverpool to be investing in their women's team. And you have to say, when Liverpool's men's team moved to AXA and they got these incredible new facilities, and then you went to Liverpool Women's Training Centre and I went there a few times, you kind of thought the disparity is just huge. So I do like the fact that they are trying to rectify that. I want to talk about the significance of Melwood as well, because obviously it's a place that's synonymous with Liverpool. So how important is it that it's being brought back to the club, in a sense?
Yeah, well, I think earlier when we were discussing sort of, you know, the link with Tranmere Rovers, and, you know, the club, I know the women's team do still maintain a good relationship with Tranmere Rovers, and obviously they've really appreciated what they've been able to do with that club. Yeah. But I think there's been a want and a will for a long time now to really improve the brand of Liverpool women, and that, you know, that means having their own space, and that means being part of the history of the club. And Melwood, obviously, it's packed full of history. They were there for, I think, over 70 years, so what better place to go and start a new era where you're creating a new culture and sort of embarking on this kind of momentum in women's football, which is just on the rise. So yeah, a really nice full circle, I think, actually, to have the women back at a training ground that holds so much history.
And as part of the move as well, Emma, and to demonstrate the team's inclusivity, the women's crest will be switched to the official club crest. I actually didn't realise, I was saying to you before, that there was a difference between the two. So just explain what is happening there.
Yeah, I actually had to double check when I got through the press release. I thought, what actually was the difference? But basically, the women's team badge has very, very large writing saying women on it. Whereas as part of this kind of move, and it's all, I guess, a statement that the club are bringing all teams together as one, rather than it now being Liverpool on a club badge and then Liverpool women on another. Both first teams will now just have Liverpool on their club badge, which again is another little subtle but very significant move.
Yeah, bringing everything together under one umbrella. Thanks, Emma, so much for coming in and talking to us. And follow, what's your at? Everyone knows you right now.
M_Sandy.
But all the latest WSL news. I'm literally like refreshing your page to see if Liverpool are bringing in anyone. You'll get all the latest news.
I genuinely had to think about what my handle was.
Thanks so much. Back to Neil in the room.
And we're back. We're still live, Rob. It doesn't stop in the gap. We're still live. Yeah. We've got Belinda and Adam with us, being still live.
Very much alive.
Interesting little shout here from Stripe263 in terms of just throwing names in the frame. Would love Paqueta from West Ham into our midfield.
For his dancing?
I think just for his general ability. I like him. I think he's one of those who's a good shout, an interesting shout. He's done really well in his first year.
Do you know who scouted him? Mo Stewart scouted him last summer. I Mo's my favourite scout because he scouted Konate when everyone else was talking about Upper Meccano. He scouted him. So if you subscribe, you get a lot of Mo Stewart and his very, very good tips. I hope he's not listening to this because he'll get a big head.
Yeah, we're not favourite praising our friends here.
No, we don't. But he did say last summer, oh, Paqueta, somebody should be in for Paqueta. Liverpool should get Paqueta. And then those hammers, cheeky hammers, went and got Paqueta, who Neil now wants for everything, including his dancing. You got more inserts to do, or should I do more chat?
It's now this till the end. You can tell we've not rehearsed this.
You can tell how authentic we are here. Okay, let me go back to my messages. Jesus Christ, my agenda.
How is me nan?
She's doing well, Neil. Well, as much as there was Turan breaking news last night on social media, there was an equal quantity deluge of Manu Kone news. The Manu Kone, for those who haven't met him, is a box-to-box central midfielder who plays for Mönchengladbach. Like Kefren Turam, he's 22 years old. Like Kefren Turam, he's walking north of 6 foot. We think maybe just 6 foot one, maybe-ish. Like Turam, he chalked up about 30 starts like last season. Neil will be disappointed to know he scored a one-goal haul. I think he got 2 assists. He looks on his heat mappy stuff, Belinda, to be a touch more attacking than Turam. I feel a bit of a fraud even speculating on this, again, because I haven't seen him play apart from enjoying his YouTubes endlessly. What's your feeling about him, his style of player, style of midfielder?
Well, so we were linked with him last summer, and I remember preparing for a gutter looking into Manu Kone. And I think last season he played more of like the box-to-box eight like you're talking about. But actually this year I've been reading up about sort of some of the differences between here and Turan, and people are saying no, he's actually played more in a double pivot with like Julian Weigl at Mönchengladbach this year. So I actually think he's probably been slightly more deeper, and people are saying that his best sort of attribute seems to be similarly to Turan, ball carrying, but actually again in a different part of the pitch. So picking up the ball from the keeper or his defence, and then breaking the lines in terms of getting the team up the pitch into the attacking half. So I think he's been operating slightly more deeper this year. Maybe that could explain as well the goals or the lack of this year. But he seems really exciting in that sense, as in potentially if we're going, so like we were talking about systems earlier, and like I have somewhat of a theory that we could still go to like a 4-2-3-1, because I just don't see where Darwin Núñez is fits into like any of the 4-3-3 iterations. So if you're doing a 4-2-3-1 to get the best out of Núñez, I think you can have a pivot of like Kone and Fabinho, where Trent still comes in when you need him in possession, or like McAllister and Fabinho, or even McAllister in the 10 with Gakpo in the 10 and Kone behind them. So yeah, that's kind of how I can see it working. But if I'm being completely honest, I don't know, because like we're talking about all these midfielders are linked to, they've played 8, 6, 10 in the past 3 seasons. So that's all of McAllister, Kone and Turam. So that one takes intelligence from all three of them, but just leaves you with so many options and so many opportunities where all three of them can fit in potentially.
I have a theory as well about the shape, wherein at the minute we refer to it as, or the cool people are referring to it as 3-box-3. And I wonder whether or not Liverpool think that it might be 3-diamond-3.
Yeah.
Where what they might do is have essentially Fabinho sits quite cleanly, McAllister and Arnold are pushed a little higher of him. And this idea of when we've got the ball, we're penning teams in, recovering it quickly, moving it quickly, being able to create the play and keep the ball zipping around, especially against low block sides. And then someone, e.g. Gakpo, sits behind someone, e.g. Núñez. And then we play that lad who wastes our time off the left-hand side and Salah off the right. And then in there, we feel as though we might have the sort of the that could give us something that we do against low blocks. That's a little bit different to the way other people are playing it. But we may feel, and then it can change, and it can all. I don't think it's going to be one set thing, and that is worth pointing out with these links and these footballers. But also, I think that Liverpool might also be trying to inbuild some flexibility across the next 2 or 3 years. These footballers that are being linked with: McAllister's 24, Thuram's 22, Kone's 21. You know, if we're signing these, we are signing them with a bit of a commitment. So the idea that they actually can do more than one thing might be our way of future-proofing ourselves to, well, we're playing like this for 12 months, but the 12 months after we might do something different. And I think the other part of this as well is that while Fabinho especially and Henderson are still around, I think there's a lot of time for people to sort of bed in. But my only other concern in terms of all of this around the bedding in thing is the manager's talked about the importance of pre-season. But the truth of it is, there's a reasonable expectation England, France, and if you want to talk about Vega, Spain, all go quite far in the Euro under-21s, which means that none of these boys will be back, including Elliot and Jones. None of these boys will be back for pre-season, as has been much touted and much planned.
Isn't it just a further week behind?
No, well, unless they choose for it not to be. No. The final's the 10th of July, and we're having them all back on the 8th. So it'll be at least a couple of weeks where they all go on holiday, unless their attitude and Liverpool's attitude is no holiday this year, boys. We'll let you have some time off in January, which I think it might be. I think that's a direction of travel for football, but that's a much bigger show and a different conversation. It will be disrupted pre-season if their teams go deep into the Euros.
Kone was spotted in, I think he posted something about him being in training with the French under-21s last night, which I think sort of suggests he might not be imminently doing any signing for Liverpool, so it might not be as close as we think. But I am intrigued, Adam, by the French under-21 association between Thuram and Kone. They are currently in the squad together. They've come through the French excellent system, if we can call it something, together. They're often pictured together. I think they were even pictured together this week. On Tuesday, they were pictured by the media together. It's strange. I can't quite get right in my head now if it's a bit of an either or with these two, or Klopp sees them as a wonderful partnership on and off the pitch. You know what I mean? There's a synchronicity between them that he likes. They're the same age, that he feels he might be buying something more than the sum of the parts.
I think it's probably six of one, really. I think it's probably one where if he can get both, I think he'd be very happy about that, because ultimately, you know, we have an engine room at Liverpool that picks up injuries because of the nature of the way that we play and the amount of minutes that these players get and the amount of time that they spend on the pitch. So I think if we've got two that are kind of effectively interchangeable, that would not be a bad thing, really. And I think, but at the same time, there's probably a preference. So it might well be that he's like, I definitely want Thuram. I'd quite like Kone as well. But if we can only get one of them, then I want it to be Thuram. That might be the way that he's thinking about things. And as you say, the kind of, the sound lads who are mates is no bad thing if that's what comes along, because we all know that kind of no dickheads policy and people who have a nice time and are going to ingratiate themselves with the rest of the squad is important to the manager.
Just to clarify one little thing here, someone says I hate Diaz in the comments. I don't hate Diaz. I just think he's a wide midfielder masquerading as a wide forward, and we need him to. And I hope he very much proves me wrong and shows me so much output next season. I'm shocked and stunned. But I think he wants to do all the midfielding and not enough of the forwarding. And we want to play with forwards because we want to win.
For the uninitiated, Neil prefers a big shout to a small shout. And this is where Diaz is unfortunately this week's four guys.
I know. I prefer the lad who came in and scored seven goals between April and the end of the season.
Diaz also scored seven goals last season between January and the end of the season. But he also started this season particularly well with his goal scoring rate until
he did a little bit better, but he wasn't quite. To me, he just looked more like a midfielder than a forward.
Gets our first goal quite a lot as well when he scores.
So, and Jota does that in spades.
Apart from the year he didn't. Anyway, we'll have this domestic away from you. Me and Neil will be watching Diaz, him seething, me praying throughout the season. This will be a soap opera you can continue watching. You don't even need to subscribe to do that, because you can just find us in Liverpool pubs doing it. But anyway, let's move in on for the roundup of Liverpool.
The last other thing, though, genuine in all of this, though.
You want the last word?
No, I'm parking that. The other thing is, we're also acting as though they're only going to do three midfielders a little bit. And when I'm talking about, you know, an attacking midfield and all of that, it could well be that there's still more to leave.
Yes,
I
agree.
I think we're not sort of, and I think that Liverpool might not even know that themselves yet, because they may be seeing if offers come in. But it wouldn't surprise me, for instance, if an offer came in for, hypothetically speaking, Thiago, that Liverpool went, you know what, we could do that at this point. I still think it's possible that an offer might come in for Elliott, where Liverpool might think, you know what, we might do that at this point and end up with feeling as though they've got the room and the space to do one more and not just the three.
I agree. I'd actually, just sort of in my roundup section, I'd quite like to pick the last bit of bones out of the Bellingham situation, because although I think we're moving on nicely from Bellingham as a fan base, I just would be interested in your opinion, Belinda, on, we now know he's signing for Real Madrid. We now seem to have an idea that the fee is maybe not at quite at the level that it was hyped that it might end up at initially. Liverpool gave the impression when they pulled out in April that it was a deal that was just becoming too costly. And they said it didn't make enough sense. Do you feel that actually what Liverpool were doing was jumping before they were pushed out by Bellingham effectively? They had got wind that Real Madrid quite reasonably had become his first choice.
Maybe, yeah. But in terms of my own opinion of how this whole Bellingham saga played out, I never ever thought it was realistic that we would sign them just because of the money involved. Like, it just doesn't make sense. It's not something Liverpool have ever done. And it's like how Neil talked about at the beginning about how you bring these players in at a certain age they're at now, because you can promise them in a year or 2 years, depending on how well you play, you can then get the next contract. Then in another 1 to 2 years, depending on how well you play, you get the next contract. And then they get to the age of 26, 27, 28, and they're going into their prime, and you've already got a good amount from them, but you're going to get more from them. Whereas if you're going in with Bellingham now, when the wages is probably on at Real Madrid, there's not so much room for improvement that Liverpool can realistically fit within their sort of structure of how they want to do business. So it never really made sense to me. I didn't believe in it just because of the number of, but the money's involved. But I'm sure he'll be fine at Real Madrid, and they've got so many options now. He doesn't necessarily need to be overplayed either. So yeah, I'm sure it's a good deal for them, and let them enjoy it now.
It's the wage is so high. So it's 210, 220 net. So that's post-tax before bonuses. A week.
So it's going to be north of 300.
North of 400.
Oh, but with the bonuses, yeah.
No, but I think he'd be on more than Salah.
Right.
I think the contract he's got in Madrid may well be more than Salah's on.
See, I said this at the beginning when this was touted. People go,
I'm shocked. I am actually shocked. I thought, I didn't think anyone would go that big at this stage, because not least because of how it inflates everything else, and you've got to worry about your own dressing room. And I take Belinda's point around, he can look after his games a little bit, but I think there's also a thing there where if you're paying someone that much money, you get them on the pitch, because you know, you put the money on the pitch. I think in the back of their minds, they know that there's one more year out of Modric and Cruz. So at some point, the wage bill comes back down and all that sort of stuff. And I suspect Modric will have taken a reduced deal. So don't get me wrong. I'm not worried about Madrid's finances. They're going to be all right. But I think it's so much money. And it is more than I thought. I thought he'd go somewhere on about 200 a week gross, and then settle there and then do this process that we're talking about. And it feels like Madrid have just sort of gone, no, we're going to skip all the way to the end, and you can just have this one now. And I think that's what, if Liverpool have got a hint of that, you know, it's one of them where if Liverpool wouldn't even have felt comfortable, I think, then approaching him and saying, all right, we'll put you on the midway point between Van Dijk and Salah, because then where's the next contract? Where does that anchor Trent's next contract? And I think that's how it's become too rich for Liverpool's blood, not necessarily the fee. And then also, if they feel like they're in a bit of a horse trading thing, as Chris Brax just sort of said in the comments, they wouldn't want to have had to have the limbo of it, will it, won't it? How long is this going to drag on for when there's other bits they want to do? It could end up being a smart move, but I am really disappointed because I think he's great, and I'm not going to act like I don't think he's great. And I think all the stuff we've talked about on this show, he does it all, and also would, you know, quite conceivably get you 15 goals a season because he is that good.
Adam, I know when we've talked about these things in the past, you're not one who wants to jump on, let's say, blaming the ownership bandwagons for the sake of it. But looking across the club, be it the transfer committee, the manager, the ownership, are you critical of the club in its widest sense for how the Bellingham story played out from its inception, maybe even 24 months ago, to the way it ended in April? Do you think they should have nipped the rumours of our interest in him in the bud, or their own interest in him in the bud, much sooner? Or did they just about get it right, given the circumstances?
I think they thought they could get him. Like, I think let's not dress this up as, oh, we were never in for him or any of that sort of thing. I think they thought they could get him. I think we've been chasing him for a long time. And I think there was a sense that we could get him. And, you know, perhaps the, you know, Bellingham's camp have kind of given that impression falsely. And that's, you know, led the club on, if you like, that sort of terminology. I don't know. But I think there's just, the reason I don't like it is I think there's a desire from some to paint people associated with Liverpool as idiots, tight-fisted people that won't open the purse strings and all the rest of it. And it's just very clearly nonsense. There is not a player at the club right now, a club, by the way, that has won every trophy that they could have won with the exception of the Europa League, that wasn't bought by FSG or brought up through the ranks by FSG and given the wages that they've been given to stay there, a la Trent. So we're very clearly, the ownership isn't tight. It's just that what they do is they look to see, well, what's the most sustainable way we can do this in the long term? And I am very much in favour of a club being able to support itself in the long term without having to have the wealth of a nation to support it, right? Now, that doesn't mean that no one can be criticised. And there's no question that looking at our midfield, more should have been done. More should have been done last summer, and more should have been done in January. And that played out across the course of the season. But I can also understand why the manager and his team have looked at a team that nearly won the quadruple. They nearly completed football, to use that sort of phrase, terminology, and felt like it could go again. Right? I can understand why they had that opinion, especially this manager that puts a huge amount of faith in people all the time. So I can also understand why everybody was thinking, well, look, you know, do we want to sign X player and not be able to bring in Bellingham? Because we've been given the impression that he sees it as, I'll go to Liverpool for 3 or 4 years and then move on to Real Madrid. That will have been the impression they've been given by Bellingham and his camp. I just don't see why they would have done it like this any other way. And the idea of, oh, they just wanted to save money, just doesn't wash for me, I don't think.
I think there's a massive thing where people, and I think it's a really, I don't think it's just an online thing, but I think there's almost some sort of notion that, and this is back to how you view your own identity and sense of self. I want to be really clear, Rob Gutman, Belinda Barty and Adam Smith and you, listener, have not lost any face in this. When everyone is trying to do the, oh my God, aren't you embarrassed? X is washed, Y is cooking, all this nonsense. The best thing to be is to be a grown-up about it and say, I just want my football team to win.
Yeah.
And I think that and by the way, there were bits like I literally walked out of Brighton when Liverpool were getting hammered 3-0, feeling a little bit embarrassed as to how awful the football team I was watching were that day. And I'm all right with that. That's a level of embarrassment I can deal with because I've paid the tickets and I've bought me tickets and I've taken my choice and I've put up with that. And I'm in a ground and Liverpool are dreadful and Brighton are brilliant and it's killing me and I'm not enjoying it. But I think worrying about, you know, if you're not careful, you end up sort of talking yourself into a situation that you should never try to go and get anyone really good in, because if you don't get them in at some point, some bellend who supports Manchester United might point and laugh in a context where Manchester United, for instance, wanted to buy Cody Gakpo in December and he went to Liverpool instead. All this stuff, I think it's, you know, I think we've got to get beyond it and remember that genuinely the stuff that matters is what matters on the football pitch. But to do that, you've got to recruit well. Obviously, you have. But I think we're just not linked to this. This is a really crucial point. Like, genuinely, you've got other things going on in your life beyond this, which is much more important to your identity. And I think that's what people get all wrapped up in. Simultaneously, there's literally very few things in my life more important to me that Liverpool win every single time that they play football. So it's a balancing act between the two things. But I think I'd rather Liverpool try to get Bellingham, failed, I think got blown out the water by Madrid's wage offer, decided they didn't want to know, and just decided they didn't want to know, which may be the right thing or the wrong thing. But I think that's what they decided. We're just not even going to engage. If, you know, I suspect there might have been a phone call from Bellingham's people to Liverpool saying they're offering us this much. And Liverpool went, all right, boys, good luck. Hope it goes really well for you, you know, because it's so much money. And I think that that's where that sort of gets wrapped up. I think there's loads of other stuff around the ownership and whether or not you want to win and what Manchester City are and where Newcastle is and what football's like at the minute. And we've talked about that.
Let's not get way existential. Yeah. No, I mean, I think transfers are really, really important. I think might be the most important thing going on. But I concur with Neil. I think you have to ask yourself a lot of questions before you just start playing blame games with people. But I do think, Belinda, it is clear that Liverpool haven't adopted perhaps the same canny approach to acquisitions as they employed in the first phase of Klopp's reign, the period, let's call it, from 16 to 19, whereby we acquired the majority of the squad that went on to do so very well and win cups and leagues, et cetera, et cetera. So they didn't reinvest in the midfield in particular at the right pace, or kept waiting for Mr. Right far too long. They waited for Tchouaméni, he didn't come. They've waited for, arguably, for Bellingham for 2 years, he hasn't come. So they have got it wrong. But not, no bad faith intended, but they've got it wrong. But let's look at I only want to face forwards, really. Do you think, though, bearing it in mind...
You barely clap Firmino off.
Yeah, exactly.
He was finished for you as far as...
King is dead, long live the king.
Yeah.
Well... Fuck the past, only about the future. I'm only interested in Liverpool's next title win. But I am interested in learning lessons from the past. And I do wonder whether, just to reference a theme we talked about earlier, if they think there might be an opportunity here to sort of, I don't want to use the word, we use this on other shows, to overbloat the squad, but to try a bit of a blunderbuss approach. Maybe bring in four young, interesting midfielders with a view to two turning out to be sensational first season, one being a project, and one being a guy you end up letting go after a year or 18 months. I mean, I wonder, I'd do that, but I'm stupid. No, I'm not. But you know what I mean? I'm childish about the need for transfers. What's your thoughts in all seriousness?
Well, first of all, I would hope that we would have learned from the lessons and not let those players that we bring in potentially just run their contracts down for the next however many years, like we did with Keita and Oxlade-Chamberlain, because we did not get the value out of them on the pitch and we did not get the value out of them off the pitch either.
Keita's gone to Werder Bremen, by the way.
That's nice.
Just been confirmed.
He's going there. He may not play there ever, but he is definitely, he looks like he's going there.
So yeah, I'd hope we'd learn that lesson first of all. But it's like you say, it's for the, again, potential wages they'd be on and potential transfer fees, it's low risk, but potentially slow burning high reward for the next few years. So in that sense, yes. And then I had another point. Actually, well,
more 35 million lads.
Rob's argument, Belinda, I think is a good argument in the context of a season in the Europa League, because it's very easy to imagine how some of these players get a number of games before we hit Christmas, which is often not the case, where you go, well, I just don't know where he's going to play. Carvalho last season being an example. Mm-hmm. If we were in the Europa League, Carvalho, I think, would have got six starts.
Yeah.
But as it is, and so that's why I think Rob's argument's good in that context, Belinda.
Yeah, and like we were saying as well, there's just so much uncertainty about these players that we're linked to, just in terms of where they fit in. So, like, Kone's played in a meh Gladbach team for 2 years. So you don't even know what his ceiling actually is, which I'm trying to frame as a good thing, because that's the value. That's where, because he's got room to develop there, and that's what you invest in. So, yeah.
Okay, Neil, is there any more administration we have to do?
That people, if they want more of this sort of thing, with maybe less of me and you sniping at each other,
they pay double for the sniping.
Well, they pay double for the sniping. Let us know in the comments if you pay double for the sniping. Can subscribe to the Anfield Wrap. They can support the Anfield Wrap in a number of ways, through subscriptions. There's YouTube on this as well, if you want to get onto the YouTube and everything that we do that goes onto there. That goes behind a paywall. And there is obviously also downloading the app and subscribing there. And you can subscribe through the website, and all of it helps support the Anfield Wrap. And all the fabulous work we do. We've done loads of shows this week for free. Harriet's just, we haven't even talked about the wondrousness, the wondrousness that is Gabby Vega. Harriet's just chatted about Gabby Vega. Is it Gabri? Okay. Yeah. I think we'll all call him Gabby in the end, in a Liverpool way, if he comes in. So she just talked to Alexander Johnson about that. That is coming out in the next few minutes. All over all the reaction stuff, all over all the insight into all the players, everything that you need. People should just be supporting the Anfield Wrap. Do you agree?
I 100% agree, Neil.
Do you think this was a good
thing
show?
We've agreed on today.
Do you think this has gone well?
I feel it's gone well.
Should we do it again next week?
Let's do it again next week.
Should we say thank you to them?
Thank you, listeners, for bearing with us. And thank you, Belinda. And thank you, Adam. And thank you, Neil. I'll give you a kiss when we're off camera in a minute.
Gorgeous. Sports Social Podcast Network.